Hello and welcome to the Buyer Insights Podcast, a show about how and why people buy. I'm your host, Liston Witherell, CEO of GoodFunnel, a digital marketing agency. You can check us out on the web at goodfunnel.co. You can also listen to all episodes of the Buyer Insights Podcast, including this one, at goodfunnel.co/podcast, and you can grab the show notes from this episode there too. You can also, of course, subscribe in iTunes or any podcasting app of your choice. Today, I'm excited to have a conversation with someone who really doesn't need an introduction if you follow how and why people buy on the web, and especially landing pages. This guy has seen more landing pages than anyone on the planet, and he dares you to make him prove it. He's obsessed with identifying and reversing bad marketing practices, and his disdain for marketers who send campaign traffic to their homepage is legendary, resulting in landing page rants that can peel paint off an unpainted wall. This man, of course, is Ollie Gardner, co-founder of Unbounce, and he tours the world literally talking about what the best ways are to put together landing pages. So I am really thrilled to have Ollie here today to talk about his expertise in landing pages and how people interact with these critical pages on our websites. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Ollie. Hey, I'm your host, Liston. I'm here with Ollie Gardner. How you doing today, Ollie?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Fantastic. I'm really excited to have you here. And you are a person, if people follow marketing, probably know a little bit about, at least, or at very least, they've heard about your product, Unbounce.com, which is just a fantastic landing page builder, which I personally use. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into it?
Sure. So I'm one of the co-founders. We have six, which is kind of weird, but also kind of awesome. We started 7 years ago, mainly because we'd observed this problem. Marketers couldn't get this landing pages done by themselves. In my career, I kind of started as a programmer, which is kind of weird. Then I moved slowly to the creative side, and then I became a marketer the day we started the company because we didn't have a marketer, so I'll do the marketing. I mean, I have a background before that in usability, and so like CRO and marketing kind of was a natural, next step.
Sure.
But definitely an interesting way to kick off a company by changing, doing something you've never done before.
Absolutely. And so you said that one of the problems you saw was marketers couldn't build landing pages. Can you tell us what were some of those big pains that you were feeling at the time that it was founded?
Yeah, it's funny. We just put a video together recapping. It was like from the founder's perspective, like going over these 7 years and what it's been like. And our CTO, Carl, he was recalling, because we've worked together on and off for like 15 years in different roles. And Rick, our CEO, was his idea. And Carl was talking about that Rick, he ran the creative team, needed to get landing pages done. And Carl was saying, well, we're booked up for a couple of quarters, so maybe in 6 months. We're like, what? We need to do a campaign like this week. So then we did the research. Are other people feeling this pain? And across the board, every marketer we spoke to said, yes, we need this product. So it was an easy decision at that point.
Excellent. So one of the things that really attracted me to you and to ask you to come on to this podcast was all of the volumes and volumes of articles you've written about landing page design best practices. And one of the things that we always talk about internally in my company is, to what degree are the way people make decisions hard-coded into people and just the way human beings are? And to what degree does it change based on technology and kind of environmental factors? So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you think people make decisions and how that affects your evaluation, say, of landing pages when you look at them.
Right.
It's a small question, I know.
Yeah, right. It's like at a conference when someone stands up in the Q&A period and asks a 17-part question. I'm not sure how much our behavior changes. I mean, it does, it evolves with technology, but I think part of it is that as designers, as writers, as technologists, we change the interactions and the way that people have to interact with us over time. You know, design and interaction trends, they change every year. Devices evolved, the people who create the things that people have to interact with are imagining new ways of doing this. So people have to kind of follow along to an extent. But that also causes problems because people make assumptions when they're designing products or interaction models. You know, like every single year, there are new trends that come along, like parallax, responsive, ghost buttons, carousel, scroll jacking. There's so many things that get put out there in front of people trying to make decisions that can actually hinder their progress, whether your copy is amazing and whether like the product is very desirable. If we don't give people the right experience, you can just break everything. And experience design is much more a thing now than it used to be. So I think we're going the right direction, but I see it getting broken every year as, you know, like, because things evolve rapidly now. Say you're a new product or you a new business and you want to put up a website or something for yourselves or a landing page, you might just buy a template. That means you're going to have that template's designers, all of their masturbatory kind of like throw every single feature and interaction model into this thing so it looks super fancy, but then it's a terrible experience. And, you know, that's taking that out of control a little bit of people because they don't know any better and they put this up there and then someone who might love your product comes along, but they're turned off by the way you make them have to interact with your site. So it's important that we educate people on not getting in people's way because people are still going to react in the same way if you have the right kind of product and message. But the way people shop is differently now, right? If someone's going to search and they're going to see a bunch of ads and they're going to command click, go bam, bam, bam on every one, they'll open like three or four tabs and they'll just go along. They'll look at these tabs. That's a behavioral change. And they'll go, oh, don't understand it, close, don't understand it. Oh, that one's clear, right? So there's a different way that people are beginning the interaction. And I think that's impacting things.
Yeah. And your comment about templates, and there's a temptation amongst all of us marketers, no matter what our particular expertise is, to stuff our templates with best practices, right? People, you know, these are the way people make decisions, so we're going to address every single one of those. And it sounds like what you're saying is, no, we actually need to choose what are the most important ways we can address the buyer. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, and also, it's not really about best practices. It's about worse. It's often worse practices, but it's about new practices. People blindly implement something that hasn't been validated through testing. You know, like scrolling on a web page. That's 20 years of interaction design. You shouldn't mess with that. But people do. You get this scroll jacking horrible phenomenon where you try and scroll and then it takes over and it tries to like accelerate and decelerate on your behalf, and you just can't control the experience. That's because someone thought they were super clever and they could change this interaction model that's works perfectly. And it's things like that push us backwards. And there's certain things you shouldn't mess with.
So I was going over one of your most shared posts of all time, where you showcase and critique conversion aspects of different landing pages. And so I was hoping you could summarize, and you don't have to do it blow by blow here, but what are some of the most important ways that you can incorporate in your design the decision-making process when someone looks at your landing page?
Well, if you go back to what I said about how people begin that journey, where you know they'll click on a bunch of ads, then it all comes down to the clarity of your communication. How well in those first 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 seconds can you communicate what you do, why it's different, and why you should continue reading that page? And people still get that wrong. You can click on 50 ads and 40 of them will take you to an unmatched experience. So if you're aware of what the traffic source and everything, if I'm critiquing something, that's one of the first things I'll look at are, does the landing page match the ad? I mean, it's such basic stuff, but still so many people get it wrong. You can look at different industries. Like if you look at SaaS software, they're typically way ahead of the curve on their marketing because they're, I guess they move very quickly and everyone's copying one another and we're all evolving. Like the SaaS model has just kind of, it's 10 years and it's, I'm thinking like 7 to 10 years and the model is maturing. Everybody does the same kinds of things. So the marketing has accelerated. You look at some of the education, 5 years behind. So there's that immediate communication. Is that right? Is it matching your advertising? Is it matching your marketing? Like my latest talk or my latest thing that I'm out speaking about, it's a thing called the conversion equation. It's an optimization framework I've just created. And a big part of that is the clarity equation. And there are so many ways to get it wrong. There's one of the aspects of it is you take your hero shot, your main image, and look at it in isolation. Does it communicate what you do, or is it actually just getting in the way? I have this funny example of Larry King, who was on some loans website, and they have a picture of Larry King, which is so incongruent with the actual purpose of this that if you looked at this quickly, you go, huh? Is this a talk show? Which is, I did a 5-second test to see if people knew what this is about. That's the kind of answers I got. So in that first instance, if you are throwing people off that seriously by like stock photography or generic screenshots of an app or something, or getting into SaaS again, like that overhead shot of the desk with the laptop and the coffee cup.
In the intent marketer behind the keyboard, right?
It's so prevalent and it's so wasteful. It means nothing and it makes you look generic. So those are some of the first things, but yeah, a lot of it comes down to copywriting. What do I like? I look at the design aspect as well. I have an ebook called Attention-Driven Design, which is about taking the 23 design principles, how you can use them to focus people's attention on what they should be doing, what you want them to do. Because people haven't really ever been taught how to design for conversion. The classic graphic design or web design is about color theory, typography, grid systems, stuff like that, and some UX best practices, but not really for conversion, not about that maximizing your value proposition and really connecting with people. And design can be used to help people do that, to focus on what they should be doing. And it's really easy the great thing about it is, and I'm not just blowing my own trumpet because I wrote this ebook, but it's because it establishes a new vocabulary. So you can talk, a marketer can talk to a designer and they can communicate in a way that makes sense. So instead of people going, I don't like that color, I don't like how this looks, can you make the logo bigger? It was years ago, there was a website, I don't know if it still exists, it was a make the logo bigger cream. It was really funny. It was all about, you know, like stakeholders or bosses that are always saying, make the logo bigger. There's some cream you could buy. I don't know. It was absurd, but very, very true. I've lost my train of thought.
Yeah, this is the hippo problem, right? The highest paid person in the room. Yeah, so if you could summarize for people who aren't familiar with conversion-centered design, how that might be different than just making something beautiful, how would you summarize that in a couple major bullet points?
Right. So conversion-centered design, to be clear for people, is a framework I developed, which is like 7 principles, one of them being attention. That's the first one. And then attention-driven design, and this is inception, but attention-driven design are these graphic design principles to focus people's attention. It's basically a campaign framework. How do you do landing pages for marketing campaigns? For design, well, distraction is the main one. You know, when you arrive on a landing page and it looks like a homepage, there's 50 links that aren't relevant to the ad. There's, you know, like no white space. There's no directional cues to point people to what they should be doing. There's no information hierarchy, visual hierarchy, so you know what the most important thing is, so you know which order you should be consuming the information. These principles kind of help you do that. So that framework, conversion-centered design, is about effective marketing. It's not about making something beautiful. And there's that constant debate where some marketers say, well, ugly converts better. That's total bullshit. It's the reason why ugly sites convert is because that person focuses entirely on the copywriting because they don't know how to design. So they're good at writing impactful and persuasive copy. Mm-hmm. If you made it look great too, it would probably perform even better, but it's just a silly argument, you know. But similarly, just because it looks great, well, then that's the kind of losing side. If you can't communicate, the copy is like, it's a massive part of it, right? It's the 80-20 kind of thing. If you can't communicate, then it doesn't matter how good it looks. But it's more about designing experience, not visual design.
Right, yeah, and understanding how people will flow through the page, right? That's part of what you mean by experience.
Yeah, and you know, an interesting, super interesting thing is that people, and I've talked about this for years, and we undo some of this stuff. Like, yes, you should probably have your call to action above the fold, but you should, and I hate saying you should test it, but you need to, because sometimes putting your CTA right at the bottom of the page can be a good thing. We found on unbounce.com, because our value proposition is so simple, people read it, build, publish, and A/B test landing pages without IT. Okay, I get it. Click the CTA. Now, it doesn't mean we have like a massively high signup rate because of that. It just means people start because like, I get it. It's too simple. It's so simple. I'll move on. But that also meant that of a like a 6,000-7,000 pixel homepage, nobody went below 900 pixels. Which means they're missing this entire experience, this story that can communicate what we actually do and why it's special. So you might like think about Microsoft Word. There's like 99% of the features you'll never use, right? But you might need one at some point. And if someone signs up without really understanding what you do or what's unique amongst your competitors, they may get in there. They may be like, oh, this is kind of cool, but it doesn't do this. And if your UI isn't good enough for them to be able to find it, or it's just not intuitive, they may go off to a competitor because they think you don't have it because they didn't read your story beforehand. So getting that initial top level kind of conversion metric isn't enough. You have to track people, cohort analysis and stuff, but you have to do this research on your page to know that maybe people aren't actually, you know, paying attention to all that really important stuff that you had below the fold.
So do you find it's actually more effective to have, avoid some of those conversions that won't actually turn into customers by making the page longer and talking more about all the different value that you bring with Unbounce?
In that case, it seems to be the case. Also on some of our PPC campaigns, for our primary value proposition, that seems to be a really good way to go. Yeah, I mean, if you think about, and this is where we're headed towards automated CRO. That's what we're doing at Unbounce. We're, you know, getting to machine learning. We have an algorithm that's predicting, you know, whether a page is, right now, with 80% confidence, our algorithm, the model, can look at a page, and based on looking at a million other landing pages, and based on looking at 20,000 that might be similar to this, like it's the page's peers, so vertical, use case, all that kind of stuff, it will be able to predict whether it's good or bad compared to them. Let's say like with a 50-50 split, is it on this side or that side? And then with language and sentiment analysis, what you can do to increase or decrease the likelihood of it having a higher conversion rate. It's really, really exciting the way it's going. And, you know, so all best practices are necessary. They're really, really necessary. That's where you begin. But then we need learning, you know, because not every situation is the same. And that's where machine learning will find these things much quicker, much more quickly than we could make recommendations that we hadn't considered. And it will change everything. It's not scary in the fact that, oh, God, I'm going to have no job because the machines are going to take over. No, they'll just give us insights much more quickly. and then we'll still have to make decisions about things, but it'll, you know, it'll do it a lot faster, and it will disprove a lot of things. You know, like we were looking at data, and everybody knows, for the most part, if you reduce the number of form fields, you will probably increase the conversion rate. Whether that's good or bad for you, because you know, decrease the quality or increase by having that change in friction, but is it actually predictive? We found that it's not predictive. Like it's not like a guaranteed thing. But when you combine it with sentiment analysis and some other copy things on the page, when you have multiple inputs, it starts to become a predictive thing. But we didn't know that before. We just assumed that you could just, you know, strip these things out and it will make a difference. Well, not always, but so I'm sure I can't wait for the moment, you know, in a year from now where I can give a talk where it's like 10 conversion best practices or concepts that we all believe that are absolute horseshit. You know, that we have data to prove are not the best way of doing it. You know, that the most exciting thing is we don't know what's going to happen. You know, like, we'll be like, wow, that actually impacts conversion, or that has no impact whatsoever. That's why I've created these conversion equations. They're kind of the human part of this, like what we can do right now to kind of model the success of a landing page or a web page in general. And what the machine learning will do, it would take my equation, and it would, which has a bunch of inputs in terms of, you know, elements on the page and aspects of clarity and so forth, and it will weight them. It'll say, oh, that's actually really impactful, so we'll 3x that. This one doesn't do a lot, we'll kind of keep that at 1x or put it down to 0.1x or something. It would weight the equation to what is actually true about conversion, and that's going to be fascinating over the next kind of 6 to 12 months.
Yeah, this is really fascinating. I have so many questions about it, but I'll limit it to just one. I assume it's going to learn in the beginning based on the history of the pages that have been in unbounce, and then ongoing it'll continue to learn based on new tests and how accurate its predictions are?
Yeah, exactly. So right now it's based on that. I can't talk about all of it, but we're releasing new features soon, which will then, it'll put capabilities on your website, not just landing pages, which means the data collection will be accelerated massively, and it won't just be about like a campaign-specific landing page. It will be about any of your pages. And it's, you know what? I completely blanked on the end of your question, but it was really good. Could you just repeat it again? Because I was going to go somewhere with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, by the way. Will the machine learning learn from your existing data set and continue to learn based on how accurate its predictions are moving forward?
Right, right, right. Yeah, absolutely. It'll be two things. Will the model be based on the pages themselves, mm-hmm. and the conversion data that goes with it, but they'll also be on the inbound traffic. That'll all get merged together, so we'll have much smarter insights. Mm. And it's interesting because right now we have a little kind of little tool page setup going on where it's an automated thing that runs on a screen. So it'll pull up a landing page, and then you look at it for a few seconds. Then it'll pull up the prediction from the model. It will say, "Is this a good or bad page in its peers?" And is it likely to be a high performing or a poor performing page? Mm-hmm. And you look at that, then a few seconds later, the truth comes up, right? What it actually is. So based on the actual conversion data, and we're just watching this, it's like a little game show, seeing how strong the model is. It's hilarious. It's so funny. We want to try and turn this into some kind of, you know, humans versus machines show or something. It's going to be so good.
Awesome. Awesome. I love to hear that. And actually, this is a decent segue when you said it has some features that would go on your website. I'm not going to pressure you to talk about those, although I'd love to hear them. But I think it's a good segue into a question that we deal with a lot, which is we see a very large difference between the mobile experience and the desktop experience in terms of buying. And what I mean by that is typically it looks like across most industries, maybe not e-com, and Amazon seems to have figured this out pretty well, but across most, say, take a normal small to medium-sized business, mm-hmm. people are doing research on their mobile device, and then later they'll go back and actually convert on the desktop. What do you think needs to change for the mobile experience in order to bring it closer into parity with desktop?
That's a great question. And yeah, I see that too, because I'm not signing up for, you know, different SaaS products or software products on my phone. I'll do research, like you say, and then I'll come back and do it. And then that puts all the attribution problems in there that people are trying to solve for their data, because you're like, oh yeah, this is converting so much more than that. But like, well, why? You know, there is that attribution to the phone, and I'm an Amazon junkie. Like, I buy so much stuff on my phone.
Me too, from the couch typically.
But that's the thing. How do we bring that excitement that exists on e-com on a phone to, let's say, signing up for a SaaS product, and say Unbounce or something on your phone, where then you're getting to the realm of all these forms that you don't want to fill in, because that's not fun. You're not buying something. But how can that journey, that's what we have to change. How can that journey be as exciting? And also, if your software doesn't work on a phone, like, you know, you can look at the builder and stuff on a phone, but you can't use it. So like, then the experience breaks down. How can you reward someone for actually signing up in a way that actually mirrors behavior? So we know that people will do research on their phone and then go sign up on desktop. How do we encourage them to sign up on their phone and ask them to go to their desktop, right? We know that the behavior exists. How can we make more people do it? So instead of just like having a bad experience on the phone, say, hey, let's get started with this, and then say, hey, let's walk over to your desk. Let's go do this on desktop right now. You know, how do we change or take advantage of that behavior that exists and make more people do it? It's a massive challenge. It's kind of, I mean, I'm making this stuff as I talk. It's kind of
really
fun.
It really is. You know, I think Apple's kind of nibbling at the edges of it with the more unified experience where you can transfer seamlessly from mobile to desktop, but it's a little beyond the reach of, I think, your average company at this point. So
yeah,
maybe we say to be determined on that one.
Right. It's gonna take, I mean, that's when I was talking about the maturity of the SaaS model or something, that means innovation is about to happen, because people can get up and running with it so quickly that the basics are no longer a problem, like billing, pricing, the pages you need on your website, you know, like homepage, features, about us, pricing, your blog, all that stuff is conceptually templated. So now it's going to come more to the innovation of experience, and whoever, you know, I'm sure there are people working on ways of modularizing this kind of experience that can go to smaller businesses, hopefully. And so whoever kind of gets there first is going to really shake it up, I think.
Yeah, you know, I had high hopes for The Grid. I don't know if you remember this startup, which seems to be much ado about nothing. I have no idea who they are or what they're doing now. But 2 years ago, they talked about inputting all of your copy and content, and a machine would decide how to place it all on the screen for your website, on the desktop and mobile experience. But I think it's been too complicated of a problem for them to figure out.
Right. I remember that. That was my vote for whatever year it was, the most persuasive landing page or homepage of the year. It was such good copywriting. It was so intriguing. You know, everybody was sharing. It's like, this is going to be awesome. And then, yeah, where'd it go?
Yeah, it still says join the revolution. So revolution seems to be an overstatement at this point. Right. And I invite them to talk to me if they want to. So now, Ollie,
strip the R off there.
Right.
It's evolution. It'll take another 100,000 years.
There we go. Now we're to the point where I'm going to ask you the same three questions that I ask all of my guests. And the first one, Ollie, is what is the biggest mistake people make in learning about their customers?
The biggest mistake, would be not learning about your customers.
Uh-huh.
You know, a lot of people don't. They make assumptions and they think they know everything about their business, which is often not the case. But if you are doing it, let's assume people are smart enough to be doing, you know, trying to learn about their customers, there are two primary mistakes. Not asking the right questions is the first one. So, you know, it is common in every aspect of research, including usability testing, customer interviews, that the interviewer will lead the participant, essentially planting words or thoughts in their mind. And this kills your data and results in confirmation bias, where you hear what you want to hear and then people speak. They tell you what you want to hear. You know, you can't include details in your questions that could potentially be part of the answer. You know, imagine you're doing a usability study. You want to know where people would go and click to watch a video of a certain feature. If you spell it out, where would you go to watch the video for the templates feature? You've told them three things: templates, features, video. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you say you're evaluating some software and your boss is wondering if it can do ABC, locate the information your boss needs. That way they're left to their own devices. You haven't given them any instructions other than like a need, an actual business need. And then you'll actually observe people doing things properly. So it's the right type of question. And a script can be really handy for that. Mm-hmm. I have a script for crafting a great testimonial. It's one of the conversion equations. It's the testimonial equation that includes all of the elements of an impactful and persuasive testimonial, where like the biggest thing is transformation. How do you show the transformation of using your product or service? So it's actually, I have a link. I put up a page for that. Like if you go to ollie.unbounce.com/listen, your name, there's a little script in there that you can interview your questions with. Being a great listener, but the other problem is not interpreting the answers correctly. You know, you might get all these great answers, but you don't know what to do with them. So I would recommend you sit down with a few colleagues from different teams, have a discussion about them, because like the research responses you've got, because everyone has different perspectives, and it will even out your biases and interpretations. And you know, so you've got to ask the right questions and interpret them correctly.
So I think I know the answer to this next question. And maybe it's getting a focus group or do some usability testing, but what is the one thing everyone can do today to learn more about their buyers?
Yeah, I did tee that up a little bit. So creating a script actually was where I was going to go with that. But interview 5 customers who have stayed with you for X period of time. So for us, that we consider someone a customer when they've paid us twice. Mm-hmm. Not just signed up or paid us once. They repeat that behavior. And again, that testimonial interview script at ollie.unbounce.com/listen. When you can do proper research and listening, you become much better at communicating why someone cares. You know, it's interesting if you speak to people like when they just sign up, or then after a month or after 2 months, 6 months, they'll have totally different perspectives. And you need to understand that journey so you can communicate the story in the right order and with the right amount at the beginning. You know, so I would recommend have a script that is consistent and interview people at different periods of time.
Now, just a quick follow-up for the SaaS nerds listening to you right now. When you say they've paid you twice, you mean on a monthly basis. If someone has an annual plan, that would count as a customer as well.
An annual plan, that's much higher intent. So, yeah, we're not going to wait 2 years to talk to them.
Right.
But we have the same business cycle, so we'd probably still talk to them, you know, after 2 months. Or it would be 3 months, so the free trial, then they've paid you twice after that.
Right. Okay. What is the one book you recommend?
It's funny, like so many books are bad. I don't really have a single favorite. I mean, like 2 years ago, my favorite, I just started as a speaker. How to Deliver a TED Talk by Jeremy Donovan. I mean, I've said it before, but it was such an impactful book for me that I love that. But aside from that, I love The Checklist Manifesto. It's a really cool book about just the history of checklists and how impactful they are.
Right.
And after reading, it's super easy read. And after that, it can change your behavior a bit and make you more effective.
Mm-hmm. By Atul Gawande, yeah, fantastic book. Okay, well, thank you so much, Ollie. I really appreciate you being here. And before we go, I know you gave out a URL, but maybe you can repeat that. Where can people find you and follow up with you after this?
Yeah, the best place to get in touch with me will be on Twitter at Ollie Gardner. But that testimonial interview script is ollie.unbounce.com/listen, LISTON. So yeah, then hit me up on Twitter and we can talk about any of this stuff.
Fantastic. Thank you for being here, Ollie.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.